This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Fingdoor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Sarah Tyson, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books and a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Luis Favela, associate professor of philosophy and cognitive sciences at the University of Central Florida. His new book, The Ecological Brain, Unifying the Sciences of Brain, Body, and Environment, is just out from Routledge. Ecological psychology holds that perception and action are best explained in terms of dynamic interactions between brain, body, and environment, not in classical cognitivist terms of the manipulation of representations in the head. This anti-representationalist stance, argues Favela, makes ecological psychology deeply at odds with dominant trends in some parts of neuroscience. In his book, Favela lays out the seemingly irreconcilable theoretical commitments of ecological psychology and neuroscience, and then defends a framework for reconciling them, what he calls the neuroecological nexus theory, or NEXT. According to Favela, complexity science provides the conceptual tools that can help integrate these frameworks, such as by articulating the key notion of affordances in ecological psychology as a kind of dimensional reduction in complexity science. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Luis Favela. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to talking about the ecological brain, unifying the sciences of brain, body, and environment. Before we get into the book itself, tell us a bit about yourself and, how you got interested in these topics, how you got into philosophy, maybe, and how the book itself came about.
Yeah, great. Again, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. Big fan of the show and of your work as well. So I'm very happy to be here. So my name is Luis Favela. Friends and colleagues call me Louis, so feel free if that's easier, but either one's fine. I'm an associate professor of philosophy and cognitive sciences at the University of Central Florida. I've been here since grad school. I did graduate school studies at the University of Cincinnati, where I did graduate training in both experimental psychology and philosophy, specifically philosophy and the life sciences. They have a really great program in Cincinnati where you, if you do the life sciences track, you have to take a certain number of courses in empirical discipline, including like quantitative courses as well. So it's one of the few programs that I know of, at least, where, they really want you to have that kind of like ground level kind of training and experience.
Yeah.
And that's particularly relevant to my trajectory because I started doing courses in experimental psych there. I was taking a perception class. And they started talking to me about these like weird concepts, like affordances. and organism environment systems and all this and dynamics and things like that. And I was coming in with, you know, I was very much into neuroscience. I was like, okay, so we're going to reduce mental activity to you know, neurons. And it's all about the brain and, you know, the brain controls the body and that's where the action's at. And you know, and I'm taking these courses and it's like, but what about the body? What about being in the world? You know, all these kinds of stuff. And oh, I got to say, Carrie, these what I came to know as Gibsonians, they really ruined me. they had me now thinking about irreducible features and emergence and quantifiable kinds of ways that the idea that we could directly perceive the world and we wouldn't need mental representations, all this kinds of stuff. And I drank that Kool-Aid, I guess, and I was ready. I became an ecological psychologist from there moving forward. And so moving forward, I've always done my work intersecting with philosophy of science and philosophy of mind, along with the, you know, empirical disciplines of psych and neuro and cog sci. And after grad school and while I've been a professor at UCF, I've had some great opportunities to really bolster my training. So I did a fellowship at Duke where I was able to learn about neuroscience. I spent some time at Pittsburgh's Center for Philosophy of Science. I got to really bolster up my phil of sci credentials. And then concurrently, I'm on a 3-year neuroscience fellowship with the Research Corporation for Science Advancement. And all these experiences, you know, I really, you know, I like to say that I walk the walk, you know, when I'm talking to neuro people about philosophical issues and the same thing when I'm talking to phil people about scientific issues, you know, I like bringing this kind of experience with me. So yeah, right. So I think that brings me to, you know, this book, which is like the culmination of my training and you know, my different experiences.
Okay, good. Well, I mean, lots of brainy stuff going on, the title, as you know, is The Ecological Brain, and you've mentioned ecological psychology and, you know, Gibson, but for people who are not familiar with that, it looks like, you know, where's the psychology, you know, in this brain body and environment thing? There's all kinds of stuff going on, but there doesn't seem to be any mind.
You know, I tried to have some sort of title that captured both the ecological psychology part and the neuroscience part. So the brain, you know, obviously is the neuro part, and then the ecological part is supposed to, you know, have a toe in the psychology pool, so to say. But I don't know if it would be helpful now to maybe say a little bit about what ecological psychology is, because I've come to not be surprised that a lot of people don't know what ecological psychology is.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's sort of the follow-up question. What is ecological psychology? My understanding is, you know, Gibson herself was a perceptual psychologist. But, you know, you're looking at it, I take it, from a broader perspective. So tell us how you interpret ecological psychology.
Yeah, so I take a really strongly historical look at the development of the mind sciences, broadly construed. And so Gibson, James Gibson, he was working in the 1940s and 1950s. He was actually a scientist, a research scientist from the Army, and he was responsible for training pilots. And one problem they had around this time was, you know, trying to get the pilot to land the planes successfully, which is a very good thing. But the way they were trained, was to think of themselves, the plane and the runway, in an absolute 3D coordinate system. And so, you know, so the Cartesian coordinate system and where they are in this kind of absolute space. And Gibson found that the pilots had a hard time thinking about that. And so he started going along on their flights and listening to them almost anthropologically, trying to think, like, you know, and capture how is it that they're actually landing. And what he found was they don't think of themselves as existing in this absolute space, but they think about themselves relative to the ground. And so really what matters when they're landing is not where they are in space, with the capital S, but where the relationship between the ground and himself is. And so pilots were talking about what Gibson would come to really emphasize, things like the ambient array or the light in the environment, specifically in the form of optic flow. And so this got Gibson thinking. He said, I wonder how much of our perception and action is guided in such a way, guided by leveraging ecological information as opposed to leveraging some sort of like abstract features, abstract measurements in the world in relation to self. And so ecological psychology ended up becoming this approach to perceptual psychology where the organism is always thought of as part of an environment. You can't separate the two. You have to explain, reaching or walking or jumping or catching. It's always about the physical features of the organism, its hand grip length, its leg length, and the kind of environment that it's in. Taken together, what you get is this emphasis on what people might know about Gibson and ecological psychology, affordances. And so Gibson introduced that term into the mind science lexicon. And so affordances are opportunities for action. That's maybe the least controversial way to put it. And so when I am able to grab a coffee cup, the reason I'm able to grab it is because I have a proprioceptive sense of myself and my body and my hand, how far it can open. I see the features of the cup, the light is reflecting off the surface over real time, this dynamic movement as I'm engaging with this cup in real time. And so I can grab it, it affords grabbing. If it was too tiny or if the cup was just really gigantic, it would not afford grabbing. And so affordances became the way that Gibson cashed out meaning and how meaning and intelligence worked for organisms. And he wanted this theory to work from a little tiny cockroach up through a mouse, a dog, a human, a bird, it doesn't matter. He tried to give a general theory of perception, and he thought that was grounded in the perception of affordances.
Okay.
It had some broader application as well through his spouse, Eleanor Gibson. I think a lot of people might know her more actually in developmental psychology. So some people know about the cliff, the visual cliff, stage of development for infants when they can perceive whether they fall off the cliff or not. I can talk about that more later. But the point being, it started as a kind of perceptual psychology, but ended up informing developmental psychology and other sub areas of psychology as well.
Okay. And I mean, the book itself, I mean, there's a, you know, kind of starts, you know, overview here, you know, explaining, you know, as you did just done, did nicely, sort of some, you know, commitments of ecological psychology, which you might go to, and then also relevant commitments of, you know, the relevant parts of neuroscience. And then the idea is these two things are somehow irreconcilable, although they are only so apparently, because then you go on to reconcile them, right? And you bring in, you know, complexity theory in order to do that. So I guess the next thing is, you know, why is ecological psychology, you know, apparently irreconcilable with the relevant parts of neuroscience?
Yeah. So, you know, when I say neuroscience in the book, I'm usually referring to a small subset of the neurosciences. So computational neuroscience, sensory neuroscience, behavioral neuroscience, certainly not including things like molecular, genetic neuroscience, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so in those kinds of neurosciences that I'm focusing on, I argue in the book that they inherited a lot of the commitments that Gibson and ecological psychologists were pushing against in the mid-20th century. And so in the mid-20th century, as you know, many people who know the history of psychology know, we had the, you know, quote-unquote cognitive revolution. And the idea here was like, oh, behaviorism can't really explain intelligent behavior completely or as well as it could, because it leaves out the internal workings of the organism. And so people like Chomsky and Jerry Fodor come along and say, there's not enough stimulus in the environment to account for a human child's ability to pick up language at the speed and sophistication they do. There needs to be some internal mechanisms that are happening there that give rise to those kinds of capacities. And Gibson, although not a behaviorist, didn't want to leverage all of his explanations for intelligent behavior on just what's happening, quote unquote, internally in the organism. He found that there was some problems with describing what organisms do in computational and representational ways. And so the idea is that cognitive systems are broadly considered a kind of computational system. They're computational in the fact that there are certain kind of algorithms that are executed in the brain slash mind, and that these algorithms manipulate representations. These representations are the meaningful units. And so how do I get language working? Well, I manipulate the meaningful words. I have semantic properties. I do this syntactically, computationally. It's all kind of happening in the brain. And this is known as cognitivism, right? Broadly construed. And it's very information processing based, like a computer. And so this idea, when focusing on perception, for example, it really disconnects, at least to the ecological psychologists, how they view the cognitivist approach. It disconnects the organism from the environment. The organism is in an environment. It has sensory stimulation impinging its sensory capacities, such as light hitting the optic, you know, hitting the retina and the eyes. But then that light is not informative enough to really tell interesting things like the distance between me and a tree. To do that, I have to use computational cues, right? So I have to, you know, I have a storage bin, if you will, of signals for distance, like angles of light and angles in the corners and this and that. This is something that we learned from David Marr. And Gibson said, well, that seems to be a lot of work that the brain has to do. And I don't even know if that's computationally possible, especially at the speed at which organisms are acting, like, say, a cheetah chasing a gazelle. What if they're not computing internally? What if they are having this kind of like mutual coupling with the environment? And what if they don't have to represent the environment? What if they perceive it directly? What if I perceive distance of a gazelle based on its optic flow and other kind of features like parallax? And I don't need to process that in my mind. And so the ecological psychologists ended up taking positions on how perception works that seem very contrary to the way that cognitivists and how I argued a lot of neuroscientists did. So one example is the neuroscientist slash cognitivist really relies on representations, representations of the world. These are the meaningful units that are manipulated by the cognitive system. The ecological psychologist is typically anti-representation. They say, we don't need to lean on the idea that there are internal models built up in our mind. We can just treat the world as its own best model. This was a quote from a famous roboticist.
I think that's Rodney Brooks, no?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. So Rodney Brooks and a lot of other roboticists were actually very influenced by Gibson's approaches because at least at the time, you know, computers weren't as powerful. They had a hard time building robots that could do simple tasks. And they were having a hard time because it required a lot of internal computing, a lot of internal generating of the external world. And they said, maybe Gibson's right. Maybe I don't need that. Maybe I can just perceive the world itself. And so they become, they being the cognitivist approach and the ecological approach, seemingly irreconcilable because they have very drastic differences in how they view even, I'll just put scare quotes up, simple activities like visual perception. And again, representation being one of those key differences between them.
Right. Well, I mean, you mentioned, you know, Fodor and Chomsky before with, you know, arguments for, you know, essentially that helped launch the, you know, the response to behaviorism, right? The need for some sort of explanatory, internal explanatory mechanisms to account for, you know, linguistic behavior and you know, other what you might call high-level stuff. So this kind of gets back to my earlier question about Gibson as a perceptual psychologist. So it seems like there's still, I worry that in a sense, people are talking past each other by focusing on different things that we do. You know, on the one hand, yeah, we don't run after gazelles, but we, we walk around trees, we climb them, we approach them. You know, so we do operate in the world. But on the other hand, you know, we can sit and remember, you know, have episodic memories of things that happened in the past, regenerate sentences, you know, kind of out of the blue often, you know, that aren't prompted by anything that we're looking at, and we're not even necessarily moving around. It just seems like there's a lot of phenomena that cognitivism was designed to account for that behaviorism didn't. And ecological psychology, as a perceptual psychology, is concerned with a different set of phenomena. And to say that, you know, we don't need representations or we do need representations seems to kind of cut the territory too broadly. I mean, maybe we don't need it for, you know, visually guided action is one of your, worked out examples. But I don't think that sort of a model seems to fit for a lot of the more, a lot of the phenomena that the early cognitivists in particular were interested in explaining. So, I guess it is, again, it's sort of a scope question. Are these two things, not necessarily, I mean, you don't think they're, you do think they're reconcilable, but to what extent are they just kind of talking past each other?
Yeah, these are all excellent points, Carrie. Let me attempt to address some of them. So I think in one sense and in certain contexts, they are absolutely talking past each other. Sometimes people will say, oh, well, why can't the Gibsonian account for this kind of quote-unquote higher level cognitive phenomena? And the Gibsonian can easily say, because it's not really our problem. That's not what we're focusing on. We're focusing on, perception and action, and at most, quote-unquote low-level cognitive capacity of some sort. So in that sense, it's right that they're talking past each other. But I think, as Gibson went on to develop his theory, as his spouse, Eleanor Gibson, ended up broadening the application of ecological psychology to developmental psychology, people were starting to see what kind of inroads they could make outside of perceptual psychology alone, with the kinds of theoretical commitments that Gibsonian ecological psychology has. And so, some people, I won't give names, but there are some people known for being anti-representationalists. But if you have a beer with them, they will say, of course there's mental representations. Of
really?
Course.
Oh, you have to make names on that one.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Because this is a big problem.
It's a big problem. But, and then this is where, the kind of, what kind of pragmatism comes in. They'll say, I really do push this anti-representational approach. But really, I do know that in the end, that there will be some things that will require, a very rich representational account. But let's see how far we can get without having to, appeal to representations. And so these people, he or she, I will not say, that I'm talking about, also includes me. I have now kind of come along in this way. I think to myself, we shouldn't come to study cognition or perception. And we shouldn't think that, computation or representation is a free lunch, right? And this comes up with some critiques that I have of cognitivism that I discuss later in the book, a group that I call uncashable checks, which maybe we might talk about later. Right. But we shouldn't think that automatically when you're studying visual perception, you automatically need representations of the environment. Like, no, you got to fight for that. And when that fight happens, I think that sometimes the ecological psychologist comes out on top. They give us a more theoretically consistent and empirically rich story. Does that mean then that ecological psychology will then be able to apply to, imagination, language, mathematical, abstract reasoning? I don't know. Maybe. But maybe not. I think it's a combination. It's a mutual theory and evidence kind of, co-development. And we will find that there are limits, I think, to what you can explain. So I agree with you, again, that there is a lot of talking past each other. But I also think that sometimes the ecological psychologist is picking a fight, and they're picking a fight that they can win in some cases. And so, again, no free lunches. Maybe I should have included that phrase in my book.
Another question. So, on the neuroscientist side, right? On not cellular, molecular, but cognitive, computational neuroscience. A lot's been written about how the notion of representation has been, stretched and distorted or replaced or, denatured in various ways within neuroscience, such that there's a lot of representation talk, but it's not necessarily as, full-blooded, you might say, as the sort of mental representation that representation talk originally had, based on, human symbolic reasoning, right? So is that another way in which, the sort of the anti-representationalism might be, kind of where the critique might not be really so, well targeted at even computational neuroscience, simply because they have moved away from, the mental representation model of representation themselves. So they kind of talk the talk, but they don't really walk the walk.
Yeah. So there's some work related to this that I did outside with Edward Mashery at the University of Pittsburgh. He and I have been collaborating for a few years now, trying to assess how various, practicing scientists use concepts like representation and other kinds of related concepts to describe neural activity. Mm-hmm. And we did, a survey kind of, based study. And in short, what we found was that there was no agreement on what representation means, shocking, among neuroscientists or within them, between neuroscientists and psychologists, and then philosophers. So we ended up having enough participants to have those three groups. And so there's no agreement. There was a lot of use of terms like the stimulus causes activity, right? Or the neuron carries information.
Right.
But in absence of the term represent, right? And it's like, okay, well, if you're not even using the term representation, the neuroscientist especially, like in any sort of like full-bodied way, as you were saying earlier, why is it such a big deal to keep using that term? Psychologists actually in our study found that they had much more stringent criteria than neuroscientists did in how they applied the term representation. And I wonder if that's part of the training. I think psychologists can have this is now my broad speaking claim, but I think psychologists might be more aware of the history of their discipline than neuroscientists need to, right? Neuroscientists can do a lot of the work they need to do. They don't even really have to pay attention to that. But the idea of like understanding, the representation of the word, it's part of cognitive psychology, came from the cognitive revolution. It was a reaction against behaviorism. Like, I think a lot of psychologists will know this kind of general story. And so I think it also follows that some of them have a more, developed sense of representation. So when I say anti-representationalism, it's, at least from my perspective, there's an eliminativist flavor to it. I wonder, what is the word linking up to? It's linking up to phenomena of the world, surely. But why is it that in the same neuroscience paper, they use the term representation, 5, 6, 7 different ways? Why not be more specific about what you mean when you're using the term representation? My bet is a lot of that representation talk is going to go away for things like, information theoretic terms or causal terms or constraint terms, and less of these like full body, semantic kinds of uses of the term representation. So So there's kind of a two-pronged attack from the ecological psychologists, including, you know, myself. One, do we need, you know, the kind of indirect mental representation, you know, in the mind to guide behavior, even if we have a worked out sense of what representation means? Or does it just, is it not even a useful term anymore for doing the kind of work we want to do?
Well, how about, like, I've been, you know, looking at some stuff recently with about Tolman and spatial navigation in routes. And, you know, his whole point was, you know, they somehow encode, represent the spatial configuration, and that, and they use that map to move around. So,
yeah. So, not to take a cheap shot, but what do we mean by encode? Right. So there's this great paper in Behavioral Brain Sciences, and I can't believe I'm forgetting its name right now. But it was basically saying, you know, is coding a proper metaphor for the neurosciences? Uh-huh. And try to cash out what that even means, right? So what does it even mean to say, you know, that, you know, spatial information is encoded in neurons? And so that work needs to be done as mm-hmm. well, right? That's part of my no free lunch kind of thing. What did Tolman mean by encode? And does it have anything to do with the way computers encode, or the way that maybe a Fedorian might think about, you know, linguistic encoding or something like that? So I'm not quite sure. Maybe, you know, are we even talking the same language that Tolman was talking about? Sure. And this is, you know, this is my plug for the work of historians of philosophy of science, right? Looking at, you know, the history of these concepts and seeing how they've evolved over time, is it really fair to compare, you know, Tolman's use of something that sounds representational to the way that a contemporary computational neuroscientist does? I don't know. And from there, it makes it hard for me to say, like, well, you know, is he then defending the kind of representation that the ecological psychologist is criticizing? I'm not quite sure. That's kind of my cheap little skip around response.
Okay, well, not so cheap. I mean, I thought that was pretty effective. Well, then, I mean, let's talk about your reconciliation of these apparently irreconcilable sciences or disciplines. So you invoke complexity theories. Maybe you can say a bit about that before we say, and then, of course, how that manages to bring about the reconciliation.
Yeah, so as you might have noticed, my first chapter was titled Making Everybody Upset.
Yeah.
And part of it is because I'm dealing with some fields of study that aren't necessarily agreed upon in how they are a field of study. And one of them is complexity science. So you talk to a different person who's a complexity theorist, and they'll give you a different definition of what complexity science is. But what I tried to do over, you know, my years of studying complexity science is try to think, what are the common types of phenomena that fall under the title of complexity science, and how are those studied and investigated scientifically? And what I found is that there's a lot of common features like emergence, nonlinearity, things like that, and a lot of common tools that are used, such as things like fractal analysis or things like that, the details of which don't really matter right now. But the point is that complexity science brings this set of concepts and tools that apply to a wide range of phenomena, and they don't really care what scale it happens, right? Is the organization of neural networks fruitfully understood as, you know, being this kind of repeating pattern, and can we quantify it in a certain way? Well, is the internet also helpfully, fruitfully understood by the same concepts and the same methods, you know, and scaling, you know, up higher and higher? And so we have this really rich and fruitful set of words and analyses to describe very, very complicated things in the world. And one of my first steps towards trying to reconcile ecological psychology and neuroscience was to try and find a common language that they could at least both use. And so I focus in on maybe four features of a complex system that both the ecological psychologist and neuroscientists can adhere to. Mm-hmm. I already mentioned two. So one being nonlinearity, the other one being emergence. The other two that I tend to focus on also is self-organization and then universality. Mm-hmm. Universality is a very highly technical term from physics, but basically, in a looser sense, it just means that same kind of organization or processes can occur in different kinds of substrates. Philosophers might know this as multiple realization. People have argued that, you know, universality is a kind of multiple realization. But the point is that complexity science gives us these ways to describe these things in different, I don't want to say realization basis, but in different kinds of, you know, form and matter. And so when the ecological psychologist is studying the dynamics of a bird flying, are there some kind of concepts and tools that we can use to describe that, that we could also use to describe what a neuroscientist is studying, maybe, you know, the neural activity associated with that? And so is there a way that now, as long as we can get them talking together and using the same kind of words and same kind of analyses, you know, let's see how much we can then start bridging together these different scales, the scale of the organism environment and the neural scale. This would then require, as part of the, you know, reconciliation process, that maybe, although they can use some of the same words, maybe some of the words don't work in the other field. So a strong, rich, full-bodied idea of mental representation is probably not going to catch on for the ecological psychologist. But, you know, maybe if we start loosening it up to maybe some sort of representation qua regular causal kind of activity, right? Maybe that's something that the ecological psychologist can grab onto. Similarly, maybe the ecological psychologist is not going to be able to get away with not using anything that even smells of representation when talking about affordances. And maybe they're going to have to start using some of that language as well. But this is going to be a kind of co-evolving. Every party is going to have to come to the table and be willing to give up a little bit. But I think the gain is going to be quite large, which is, you know, connecting these scales.
So, yeah. So maybe you can give an example. I think in the book you, because the concept of affordance is so, you know, central to ecological psychology. How does the complexity theory approach, provide a means to explain affordances, and where, how does the brain come into that?
Yeah. So, one big feature of complexity science has been the notion of dimension reduction. And so dimension reduction, loosely speaking, is taking large amounts of data and finding ways to process it until you find the principal structure. So the idea is that not all the activity is necessary, but maybe some of it is more necessary than others. And so the idea here is that what affordances are essentially is a dimensional reduction of the ecological information, the organization of the body, and then neural states. So there's a kind of coordination among this low dimensional mode in the brain, and this comes up later when I talk about neural manifolds. The neural manifolds have become a really useful way to talk about these low dimensions in neural activity. Those have systematic relationships with, and here's another term, synergies of the body. So when bodies organize for a certain kind of action execution, they combine, they recombine, they're soft assembled into these synergies. So there's a relationship between the low dimensional synergy, the low dimensional neural activity, and then a low dimensional conception of the environmental or ecological information. Now, I keep saying ecological information, and I think I might be doing ecological psychologists an injustice to your listeners, because ecological information is a very particular thing for Gibsonians. Ecological information is not understood in terms of maybe Shannon Weaver information. It's like communication theory. That's not quite it. The kind of information that we think of as, you know, computers having like ones and zeros and bits and stuff like that as being a kind of information. That's not what the ecological psychologist is talking about. What they're talking about is basically informative energy is in the environment. And that might make some people roll their eyes or start thinking that this is like crystal healing or like the metaphysics section of Barnes and Nobles, where you start conjuring your spirit animal or something like that for the energies of the environment. No. Gibson just meant like literally like the physics, right? The energy in the environment, like the light waves, right? The sound waves and things like that. That's what he meant by ecological information. And the kinds of information that different organisms can detect through this co-evolving between an organism's capacities and what the environment offers makes that information what grounds the affordance or what specifies it, as the ecological psychologist does. So when I see a cup in front of me as affording grasping, that affordance is specified by, at least in part, the light, the ecological information, the light reflecting off of its surface. So my story is that specific specified information, ecological information, is a low dimensional feature of the environment. There's a lot of information going on, a lot of energy in the environment, right? There's a spectrum of light that I can see and that I don't see. That in itself is a lower dimension of the kind of energy that's in the environment. And so this complexity-based approach that I offer, I call it NEXT, the neuroecological nexus theory, is an attempt to say, how do we address the relevant neural scales and find the lowest dimensional activity needed for connecting the body's synergies to the environmental information to guide intelligent behavior? And so this kind of dance, this coordination between the different scales, is when we get what I call affords events, events that are intelligent for the organism. It takes the multi-scale spatial temporal scale, kind of a dance, a flow, a coordinating between them. But they're best thought of through these complex systems tools that aim to reduce the data, aim to reduce the dimensions to just those most relevant.
Well, okay, so you mentioned direct perception, earlier on, and I did want to ask about that, and that seems relevant right now because, if I perceive, a piece of chocolate as, edible, or a glass as breakable, or something like that, it seems like I need to know what chocolate is or what glasses are. In other words, there seems to be some sort of cognitive aspect to even affordance talk, where the organism needs to have some sort of ability to categorize things in the world that isn't in the perceptual, energy. Do you disagree with that, or how do you account for that within the neuroecological nexus theory?
Yeah, good. So, one slick move I can say is, maybe you don't need those concepts or, some kind of story like that. But no, there is some recognition of the chocolate as being edible, the glass as being breakable, as you said. And so where does that come from? I think what the ecological psychologist wants to do, what I want to do as well, is say, do we have to automatically go back to this kind of computational wording, right? Do we have to go back to the idea that we have a storage, a memory of these things, that these, I have encoded, that chocolate is edible? Or is it more that there is just kind of regularities that an organism experiences in its life, and that these categories, and I use that loosely, these categories are not thought of as, strictly, understood as like the kind of category that we'd write words, right? So what are color words listed? What is this? And then listed. But it's more like the kind of regularity that an organism has experienced over evolutionary time, over developmental time, And that those have given disposition to an organism to perceive in a certain way, to engage with certain objects of the world in a certain way. And so my non-answer answer is, first, how are we even talking about this phenomena? Are we already loading our descriptions in a kind of cognitivist way? What would it look like to not account for it in that way? And is that what the ecological psychologist is offering? And I think they are. I think we could do a lot of work by talking about dispositions talk, by talking about regularity talk, and not necessarily jumping into what I'm calling like Lucy's kind of computational or cognitivist way of thinking about things. That's not to say like it might not end up getting there for some of these phenomena. We might end up having to talk in this computational, cognitivist representational kind of way. But I think it's far too early for us to think like, oh, that's free lunch. That's it. They get that's the explanation. It has to be in that way.
Yeah.
It reminds me, yeah.
Go ahead. Good.
So I presented at a conference. I'm being really cryptic today, Carrie. I'm not going to say what conference. It was about computationalism and whether neuroscience is properly cast as like a computational kind of science. And I was arguing, I know, at your jaw, it's about to drop, that no, neuroscience is not properly cast as a computational kind of science, right? And I gave this kind of arguments and this and that. Later on, during this conference, another person who's a big name neuroscientist referenced my talk and said, you know, some people think that, you know, neuroscientists, they don't have to talk about the brain in computational terms. Some people, and again, referring to me, you know, I brought up the point that like cultures throughout history, they tend to explain the mind based on like the hot technology of the time, right? So the Romans, it was like the mind is like an aqueduct. You know, the internet computers happen. The mind is like a computer. You know, internet gets popular. It's like, no. The mind is more like a network, you know, or something. Right. And this person said, the difference between those analogies and metaphors and descriptors and computational descriptors is that the brain is actually a computer. And my mind just like exploded in that moment. I said, oh my gosh, like, that's the whole, like, to be, people are just so, you know, steeped in a kind of way of viewing the world, you know, kind of, you know, their perspective. And the perspective of computational talk has just got people, even our brightest minds, are just trapped in talking about, you know, minds and brains in this kind of computer kind of way. We can't even help ourselves, I think, sometimes. So the task of coming up with different words to describe the phenomena, it really is an uphill battle, I think, culturally at this point.
Well, part of the issue, and I'm sure you're very familiar with Gualtiero Piccinini's work on computation, neural computation, physical computation, where, you know, this unnamed major neuroscientist is saying the brain literally is a computer. That doesn't necessarily mean it is literally a Turing machine. You know, again, I mean, the same sorts of, assumption, I suppose, that we have a von Neumann machine in our heads. I don't think that's the kind of thing that he would mean. I think the issue is really just we keep coming up with information of some sort that seems to be, you know, stored, if I can use that word, in the brain, in some form of memory, long term, and then it gets accessed and used and reused in different contexts. I think that's kind of where the neuroscientist or this major neuroscientist is saying the mind is like the brain is like a computer, not it's not a von Neumann machine. It's but it is, you know, again, to use the phrase that you used earlier, it is an information processor of some sort. So you do have information, and there is information that does seem to stick in the machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you know, the idea of like retrieving information, and, you know, that we have memories and that we're thinking, it's always like a kind of act of retrieval. Previous things we knew mixed with new things that we know. This has lent itself to the way we think that computers work. Again, I don't know why we should take that as a given. Now, let me give you two reasons why I say that.
Uh-huh.
One is, while it's very useful to study memory as if it was the encoding of information, I think we need to be careful not to reify our metaphors. And what I mean by that is, just because something helps us to understand a phenomenon, so if I use one word to understand another word, doesn't mean that the word that I'm using is actually what that thing is. It's just a helpful way to think about maybe designing experiments or data analyses. I think there's a risk of successful experiments, successful analyses running way too far ahead of what they were originally for. And then they make you think, oh, well, then the phenomenon that I'm investigating, it is like the analysis that I use. So if I'm using, you know, linear statistics to analyze a phenomenon, it doesn't mean the phenomenon is actually linear itself. It just means that the mathematical tools were helpful. And I just wonder if that's the case when we apply, you know, the idea of computation, like wording, like retrieval and memory and storage, like that helps us design experiments, but I'm not quite sure. You know, I think we need to be careful to not apply that to the brain if that's not what the brain is doing. Mm-hmm. And second, I think there are potentially rich avenues to explore of non-computational ways of thinking about even heavily computationally worded phenomena like memory. And I have a colleague, and he and I have been discussing ideas of talking about memory in a more kind of dynamical systems kind of way, or at least inspired kind of way, that'd be more consistent with ecological psychology, in which memories are not things that get put away and stored in our retrieve, but they're always that kind of, and I use this loosely, scare quotes for the listeners, but that information is always active in a way, and we just give more attention to some of that activity than others. And so it's not about accessing what's put away. It's about identifying what's already there, giving it more attention. Who knows if that's going to work out?
Mm-hmm.
But it's potentially experimentally viable. It can help us to understand, conceptually interesting. And it might end up panning out. It doesn't require thinking about the brain as being a computer. So, that's where I would go with that.
Okay. We're running out of time. We could keep going, but we don't have the time to do that. So, let me just end with a question about, you know, where you're going now after putting your neuroecological nexus theory on the table, defending it, explaining it. What are you working on now?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So this conversation has kind of been going the direction of where I'm going. So, you know, the book is, you know, I try to tell a story about why ecological psychology and neuroscience has come to be viewed as irreconcilable. This has, I think, broad lessons for not just ecological psychology, but a lot of the different theories that it's come to inspire, like so embodied cognition or extended mind or things like that. A lot of those find direct inspiration from Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I try to tell this historical story about why this has happened, this irreconcilableness. And then I try to give a theoretical and empirically based story about how these can be reconciled. And I give the example of just one affordance, so the affordance of pass through a bowl, mm-hmm. the ability to walk through an opening. And I try to tell this story and I say, hey, you know, I am able to maintain Gibson's core commitments. I'm able to give a non-hand wavy story about what the brain is doing during these events. Cool. All right. Great. But as you've been pointing out, and as I've been talking to some other people about, okay, so maybe we're willing to let you get away with this for you know, again, quote, low level cognitive phenomena or low level intelligence that's just, you know, involves perception and action. But what about the real stuff? What about the real cognitive phenomena, sometimes referred to as the representation hungry processes, things that would be really hard to explain without appealing to representations or appealing to computations? And so moving forward, I'm starting to now expand my account, or at least attempt to apply it to these higher level cognitive phenomena and what that would look like. So hopefully, come up with something. I've been toying around with, so this book was called The Ecological Brain. I've been toying around with the idea of a sequel just called The Ecological Mind, focusing more on, you know, what people typically take as mental phenomena or cognitive phenomena.
Good. Well, I'd be very interested in seeing that sort of reconciliation. Yeah, in fact, I kind of mentioned that title inadvertently when we started. But yeah, I mean, this is sort of the issue that causes a lot of dancing around and, you know, but no good answers. And so I wish you luck in giving us a reasonable answer to these questions.
Thank you. I'm going to need the luck. Since this was easy to do, it would have been done already.
Yeah, well, exactly. So that's what we like, challenges. But we're out of time now, but I do want to thank you again for taking the time to talk with us at New Books at Philosophy about your new book.
Thanks, Carrie. It was a lot of fun. Appreciate it.
Okay. Good luck with the new work, too.
Thank you.
Bye. You've been listening to my interview with Luis Favela, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Cognitive Sciences at the University of Central Florida. We've been talking about his new book, The Ecological Brain, Unifying the Sciences of Brain, Body, and Environment, which is just out from Routledge. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.